last week that it was shifting its vaccination policy to delay the period between the two doses from the recommended 3 weeks to up to 12 weeks in order to vaccinate more of Britain's most vulnerable. The producers of the Pfizer vaccine and the US drug regulator, the FDA, and various immunologists have come forward to point out that that's not what the drug trials have looked at, so we are, in effect, taking a punt that it's probably going to be okay. Is this a good idea? Joining me to discuss are clinical epidemiologist at Queen Mary University London, Dr. Deepti Gurdasani, and Professor of Immunology at Imperial College London, Danny Altman. First question to you both. In a word, do you think that delaying the second jab is a good plan?
I'm not sure I can give a yes or no on this. All I can say is I can definitely see the pros and cons and the arguments on both sides, and I'm happy to elaborate on that later.
Good, because that's what we're going to be discussing. Danny, you?
Oh, I can't help very much either. So, you know, I respect the comments from JCVI and from Chris Whitty about how in the heat of battle, generals sometimes need to take drastic, sudden decisions to save lives. And yet, you know, I was witness to all the professors of immunology around the world piling into email and social media saying, what on earth is going on in the UK? What were they thinking of? So, you know, more to discuss.
Well, let's get to it. First off, Danny, there are two jabs given with both the AstraZeneca one and the Pfizer, the Moderna. Why two? What's each one doing?
Yeah, so I think that's been a source of quite a lot of confusion. So when I look down my WHO list of the vaccine tracker for all the different vaccines we're rolling out in the world at the moment, it looks like a random number generator, yeah? Because there are some that have one against them as the number of boosts to be given. Some say two and some say three. And so these are kind of, you know, empirical works in progress to try and get the best, most lasting immune response out the other end. And the reason that a common answer is quite often two is that the first time your immune system meets that bit of bug, it's called the antigen, the bit that's recognized by the immune system, it gets turned on, gets activated, and lays down the thing that we call immune memory. And the second time it meets it, it does much fancier stuff and really fine-tunes the immune repertoire so that you get those really super antibodies that can really hang on to the virus with high affinity and really stop it getting into cells. So the argument would go that in an ideal world, you don't get your really super fine-tuned immune response until the second time.
So with these vaccines, they come with guidelines, and it says, give the first dose, wait 3 weeks, 2 weeks, give the second dose. We've shifted that in the UK to up to 12 weeks. Do we know what the consequences of that are, Deepti?
So there are two vaccines. With the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, the original trial included different gaps of dosing. This was not done necessarily by design, but because the original protocol was supposed to be to evaluate a single dose and the second dose regimen was added later on, naturally people who were recruited earlier had a longer gap with vaccination, and those who were recruited later had a shorter gap with vaccination. So because of this, the Oxford trial actually has data on this longer gap, although in the more younger age group, in under 55s. The bigger problem, I think, is for the Pfizer vaccine, where the protocol was very clearly adhering to a three-week gap. And this is a deviation from protocol because we don't actually have any data on the longer gap as opposed to the AstraZeneca vaccine, where we do have this data.
Okay, so for the Oxford AstraZeneca one, there is some data out there looking at some people who had a bigger gap between jabs, and that's not the case with the other one.
Absolutely. So with the Oxford vaccine, they did actually do a subgroup analysis looking at whether a duration of a gap of less than 8 weeks versus more than 8 weeks made a difference, and they found no difference in efficacy between those two groups. I think the developers of the vaccine have recently said that unpublished data, which is not in the public domain, suggests that a longer gap might be associated with a greater efficacy. But not having seen that data, I can't really comment on it.
That's really interesting. So, Danny, that if there's suggestion that maybe a longer gap gives you more efficacy, then why are so many immunologists emailing saying that they're worried?
Lots of reasons. So partly because we're to come to these decisions, we're having to kind of conflate the data, aren't we, between what was done, although not formally reported, for the Oxford vaccine and what hasn't yet been done for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, and sort of mix and match and say, well, if it's true for one, on average, it might kind of be true for the other, so let's take a punt. And we're not used to doing public health on the basis of taking a punt. We're used to really, really amazingly stringent regulatory processes based on thousands of pages of data. So it's hard to say whether what's true for the Oxford vaccine necessarily has to be true for the Pfizer vaccine, because obviously they're very different platforms. One is a chimp adenovirus from Oxford, and the other is an mRNA from Pfizer.
But, I mean, they're different platforms, but they're still doing the same thing. It's an antigen to provoke an antibody response.
Yes, but in terribly different ways, yeah? So immunology is a very complex academic pursuit where the devil is in the detail. So if you gave me infinite time and infinite money and infinite number of vaccine volunteers, I would design a very big, elegant study for you where we would try lots of different vaccine doses and lots of different time intervals, and we would measure the quality and quantity and durability of response. And I promise you, we'd get enormously diverse answers, some of which would be very desirable with enormous levels of protective antibody, and some of which really wouldn't be that good, all out of the same vaccine. So in an ideal world, you'd kind of want to get it right.
Yeah, and in an ideal world, you'd build a model of the world the size of the world. And I mean, this is a pandemic where it seems that someone described it as the ship of science is being built as it sails, which I quite liked. But that's an atmosphere where you really need to be okay with taking a punt on something, because it's not the absence of data completely. It's some data, but the sort of bits of a jigsaw puzzle that you can put together to give you best guess that might save thousands of lives.
You can hear in my voice that I'm kind of equivocating, can't you? because, you know, like I said, you know, between...
I'd expect nothing less from a scientist.
Yeah, you know, but, you know, I said, you know, being deluged with outraged comments from very, very knowledgeable colleagues in the States and in Europe, saying, you know, what on earth is going on there? This is completely off beast, off protocol, unwarranted. You know, how on earth can scientists be allowing this to happen? And, you know, yet understanding where the decision came from.
Deepti, can I ask what you think about that?
So the rationale presented by the JCBI as to why this is being done is the thinking that it's better to vaccinate double the number of people with a single dose and get at least partial protection in terms of disease compared with vaccinating half the number of people with the full dose with the full degree of protection. An assumption, of course, built into this is the fact that after one dose of vaccine, we will have efficacy that lasts for at least 12 weeks, that doesn't wane significantly and is comparable to what was reported in the Pfizer trial, so in the range of 86%, which means that we would then be having double the population with a relatively high efficacy compared to vaccinating half that amount with the efficacy of 95% reported in the Pfizer trial. Of course, we don't know this, and you know, there's a huge amount of uncertainty about this because the trial didn't do that. The trial gave the first dose at a point in time and gave everybody the second dose within 21 days. So we don't have that data between 21 days to 12 weeks to actually say that it wouldn't impact the efficacy and that the impact in terms of efficacy wouldn't wane during that period of time. And that's what's really led to this controversy, because we are really deviating from trial protocol and what's been studied, and we don't really know. So a lot of this is in some way based on our best guess efforts at the idea that it's unlikely that the immune response will wane so rapidly between the two doses. And if that is true, then of course it makes sense to then vaccinate as many people as fast as possible, that there is a lot of uncertainty around these estimates because they haven't actually been tried out and studied.
If you're reducing the efficacy from 90 to 70%, that means by doing a single shot rather than two, Would that mean that you've got more people catching it? But presumably, if more people catch it and they've been vaccinated, the symptoms will be sort of, do you get some kind of
immunity? Yeah, that's right. It becomes a very kind of detailed discussion of the minutiae, doesn't it? Because throughout all of this discussion, one of the factors has been, you know, what are we measuring here? Are we measuring a limitation of symptomatic disease? And are we saying we'd be happy if we just had people having a sort of low-level COVID-19 infection, but they weren't being hospitalised and they weren't going to ITU and they weren't dying? We might be, but then the long COVID community and researchers say, but you'd still be leaving yourself with a legacy of long COVID. Or you say, well, are we looking perhaps for what's called sterilising immunity, to actually wipe out the virus in people's lungs, which is a much bigger ask. And some of the vaccines, it looks to me, may be able to do that. So you know, what are we trying to achieve here, and what are we trying to measure here? And you come back to this argument about, you know, heat of battle and needs must, and let's not be perfectionists. Let's just say that even a less efficacious vaccine regimen will get you to the stage where people aren't, flocking into the hospitals extremely ill. They're perhaps getting a much milder infection or even an asymptomatic infection. And for the moment, you know, we'd settle for that.
Deepti, I think one of the really important things is that if we are going to go off-piste, as it were, that is there some way of doing that in a more organised fashion so that we can provide data that people like you can look at and actually work out for the rest of the world and for ourselves whether we've done the right thing, whether there are what the consequences actually were.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's essential to actually build in an evaluation into this if we are going off trial protocol. I think we need this to collect data to understand the implications of this, and also from a public trust point of view, and also to inform, I guess, such dosing regimens across the globe, because I know that there are other countries who are also considering this in the midst of a crisis. If we take steps like this where we essentially deviate from known protocol, what we need to do is really mitigate the effects of the uncertainty as far as possible by studying this in detail and in real time, so that if we find that these approaches don't work as well, we can change our practice in the real world, or if they work even better than expected. Similarly, you know, we can have the confidence and the trust that we're doing the right thing.
You know, I don't know if Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock listen to this program, but my big, big plea is that we can't do this in the dark. If we're going to do it, we need to collect the data. And as an immunologist, the data that we need is the longitudinal immunity data. So if you go off piste and you're doing this in the dark, can we illuminate that by taking quite large numbers of people, following their protocol, and mapping their antibody and T-cell levels longitudinally? How much do they have on board at 3 months? How much do they have on board at 6 months? Otherwise, we might be kidding ourselves that we have an immune population when we really don't.
So is there any work going on at the moment? And how would you get that data?
It would be so easy to do with the will to do it. So it's, you know, lots of us are doing it on a, you know, research basis in our cohorts. But we kind of need it at the public health level. Otherwise, as I said, you know, we may be fooling ourselves.
Deepti?
So I think a trial could be easily designed and done actually within a short period of time. And I think the sort of design of the trial we would need would be a randomized trial. It would be a randomized pragmatic trial rather than a randomized blinded trial with potentially, I think, three arms. So we should have obviously the standard arm, which is as per the protocol, where the two doses are given 21 days apart as recommended. And we have two other arms, potentially with dosing gaps of 8 weeks and 12 weeks to represent different dosing gaps. And, you know, we have experience with doing trials like this quickly, as evidenced by the, you know, Oxford AstraZeneca trial and the recovery trial. And the sort of outcomes we need to look at will include things like symptomatic COVID, like have been measured in trials before, severe COVID, as well as preferably asymptomatic infections by self-swabbing, as well as from seroprevalence data. And I think, as Danny said, it's very crucial to include the immunological endpoints at different points in time. For example, you know, before 21 days, before 8 weeks, before 12 weeks, and of course the longer term impact of these gaps in dosing. And you know, that can be done in a subset of participants and needs to be done in detail to really understand the impact on the immune response and the ability to neutralize the virus, both in terms of the current strains and other strains that are circulating, and over the longer term, because you know, a trial on clinical endpoints will obviously take much longer, and it's very important to do, but we need to also have very quick data on changes in immune response, both qualitatively and quantitatively over this period of time, so that we can rapidly apply this to practice if we find, for example, that the immune response is not as good as in depth or breadth, either due to delays in dosing or even following the booster, for example.
Does a single vaccine increase the risk that you'll get new mutations?
Yeah, Danny? Yeah. No, so you know, it's hard to put a number on the increased risk, but in the simplest possible sense, absolutely yes. So if you speak to the kind of immunologist or virologist who does experiments to look at the risk of escape mutants, the way in a laboratory, for any virus, not just this one, that you try and generate escape mutants to study would be to set up a culture system where you were adding virus to cells and then you were adding in suboptimal concentrations of antibody to get a bit of selection going and see what the sequences were of the viruses that escape, okay? So that's how you do it in a lab. And some would say, or certainly, you know, certainly American and European immunologists would say, that's exactly what the UK is threatening to do at the moment. So yes.
Yes, I think it is a real risk, and I think people are concerned for a good reason.
I think some of our listeners who will be the guinea pigs might be quite alarmed by what they've been hearing. So do you have any words of comfort for them?
I'm not even sure if we needed to have this discussion and if we kind of blinked too early, because for me, the bottom line is that having had, you know, a few kind of hiccups in our handling of the pandemic before, the UK has done rather well in vaccine rollout, and for the moment at least is near the top of the vaccine rollout list. My dearest hope is that this whole discussion will prove to be unnecessary and obsolete, and in fact this whole show will prove to be obsolete, because we'll have plenty of vaccine coming through. And my advice would be not to let any of this kind of squabble undermine confidence in the vaccines. Having any of these vaccines is the best way to produce a high level of neutralizing antibody, and that's the best way not to get infected with this virus and not to get sick. And we should all grab any vaccine we're offered under any protocol and not let anything that I've said or anybody else have said undermine that confidence.
Thanks to Deepti Gurdasani and Danny Altman.